Good morning and welcome to Talk Louisiana on June 14th, this Flag Day. This is the day in 1777 that the Second Continental Congress adopted the flag of the United States and the design that we use today. This is also the day that the U.S. Army celebrates its birthday because 2 years earlier, June 14th of 1775, Congress adopted the American Continental Army. So happy birthday to the U.S. Army. We are thrilled to have you here with us today. My name's Julie Baxter Payer. I am sitting in for Jim today, and he will be back soon this week. We want to welcome you to Talk Louisiana. We're going to talk about the new LSU Military Museum that has just opened up in the Memorial Tower on LSU's campus. Later in the show, we'll also talk with the president of Council for a Better Louisiana, Cable's Barry Irwin, for a look at the lows and highs as Cable sees it coming out of the nine-week session that just ended at the Capitol last Thursday evening, mercifully. But first, as a result of that session, we want to talk about what is going to be a new day, really, for Louisiana children coming up in K-12 education, particularly as it pertains to the K in that equation. Kindergarten will now be mandatory in Louisiana. And the man responsible for introducing that bill joins us now live in studio, Senator Cleo Fields from right here in Baton Rouge. Welcome to Talk Louisiana.
Well, thank you, Julia, and it's good to be with you.
It's probably good to be past the session, too, right?
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. Absolutely.
And we're going to talk a little bit later. There may be another one coming up, if not at the end of this year in January for redistricting, but we wanted to talk to you today. You chair the Senate Education Committee, but what in particular this year spurred you to take on this topic, making it a law that kindergarten is mandatory in Louisiana?
Well, I wanted to have a centerpiece legislation. I wanted to have a piece of legislation that was aggressive and that really, you know, zeroed in on early childhood education. So I talked to the staff, Jeannie, as you know, and Cheryl. They're very seasoned and very, you know, very valuable employees. And they have been, you know, legislators have been trying to pass legislation to make kindergarten mandatory. And it goes back to, you know, until like 96. And the Board of Elementary and Secondary Education has been opposed to it. You know, legislators, you know, they've passed resolutions, and they just haven't been able to get to the finish line. So I said, we need to do it. I mean, we can't talk about early childhood education and we not have mandatory kindergarten. So I got all of the stakeholders together at the beginning of the year and got them all on board, with the exception of one group, but we got them close to being on board. And I just said, listen, look, we can't talk about early childhood education. We know it makes a difference in a child's life. You know, 90% of the brain develops between a birth to five. You know, let's make kindergarten mandatory. And I'm very happy that all of the stakeholders got on board very early. I mean, all but one. And it's now in the law, and it's a good thing for kids in Louisiana. And hopefully other states would follow our lead. We have 12 states now. We're the 13th state that makes it mandatory, and it's going to be very profitable for our kids in the future.
Signature support for Talk Louisiana comes from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and Vantage Health Plan. If you'd like to talk to Senator Fields, or if you have a question about mandatory kindergarten or the results of the legislative session that just ended, you can call us at 1-877-217-5757. It's 1-877-217-5757. And Senator Fields, we know that this was part of the governor's legislative package as well. He supported this. Right now, prior to your bill, Louisiana children are required to attend school from the ages of 7 to 18 unless they graduate early from high school. And you mentioned 90% of the brain development happens between birth and age 5. And yet, you had some opposition to this bill on the floors. In the initial final passage vote on the Senate floor, one senator, Senator Heather Cloud, voted no. And then in the House, for the adoption of the final version of the bill, the conference committee report, 34 House members, as it happens, all Republicans, voted no. What was the specific opposition that you encountered to this bill?
Well, I mean, first, let me talk about the opposition in the Senate. Heather Cloud voted no the first time, but she did vote for the final passage of the conference committee report. So we really didn't have any real opposition in the Senate. The Senate was pretty solid. I mean, my colleagues in the Senate understand the need to educate children early. In the House was a little different, but you know, I'm very thankful. I mean, we always had a majority in the House. We switched some votes in the House in the conference. There was some talk the first time when we had the vote. The gentleman from Shreveport, he was concerned about sending kids to school too early, and I understand that. I mean, we were sending kids to school, some kids at 4 years of age, but his amendment to the bill basically, you know, kept kids out, half of the kids who we were trying to help out of the school system. So we changed the bill whereby if you reach age four, September the 30th, but you start school. I mean, when school starts on September the 30th, and you're age four, you have the option. You can send your kid to school, or you could choose not to. So we changed that in conference, and we still, you know, catch most of the kids, and so now it's the law. You know, when a kid turns five, September the 30th. They must be in, you know, either some type of early childhood education, or their kid, or their parent has the option to enroll them the next year. So.
And this takes effect in the 2022-23 academic year.
Yeah, not this upcoming year, but the year after next.
So more than 50,000 students were enrolled in kindergarten, right, in this past fall. And the estimates that I saw were that about 2,800 eligible children did not attend. Where are these children now?
Well, because of the two hurricanes and the pandemic, we lost a lot of kids in kindergarten and throughout the state. I mean, we lost them K through 12. But I think the Department of Education is going to be aggressively seeking kids to re-enter the school system this year and next year. And the fiscal impact of the bill was $12 million. I don't think it's going to have that much of an impact immediately, although I hope it does. But we have to do a better job at getting our kids back into the educational system, and we have to do it soon. Yes, K is about 54,000 kids.
Okay.
We are right at about 51,000 kids now. The estimate is about 2,800 kids. We weren't tracking the kids properly, in my opinion. So we really don't know the true number of kids we have, you know, that have slipped through the cracks. But now all kids will be required to attend kindergarten.
If you'd like to talk to Senator Cleo Fields, the number's 1-877-217-5757, 1-877-217-5757. What about enforcement? What happens under this new law if parents don't send their children to kindergarten?
Well, they're going to be under the same laws that if you don't send your kid to first grade, or second grade, or 12th grade, I mean, you know, from ages 7 to 18, I mean 17. You know, kids must go to kindergarten, and if they don't go to kindergarten, you'll be under the same penalties that you are under the present law. So, you know, parents must take it very seriously, and the Board of Elementary and Secondary Education, they're going to fall under the truancy laws, and law enforcement will, you know, certainly exercise whatever jurisdiction they have to make sure the kids are in school.
You had at least one opponent who testified before one of the Senate committees that some data, apparently it did come from the 1970s, but showed that kindergarten has no educational benefit and could create behavioral problems. Any thoughts on your critics?
Well, you know, some people spend more time being critical and less time being correct. I mean, all data shows that the earlier we intervene, the better results we get. I mean, kids learn more when we start early. And for those parents who want to keep their kids at home, we put an exception in the bill. You can't keep your kid at home if you feel that your kid will learn more at home. Then you have, you know, you can do that. You can keep your kid at home and teach them at home. Just register that kid with the Department of Education so that we can track the kid and make sure that the kid is receiving some type of education. But for those who feel that way, I mean, look, I certainly don't feel that way. The earlier we intervene in a kid's life, the better results we will get in the future.
Edwin from Livingston is on line one, and we'll go to Edwin. Good morning, Edwin. Welcome to Talk Louisiana.
Well, Mr. Fields, good morning. My question is, I'm glad, I'm very glad that you're moving in this right direction. But what's your next step in helping education in Louisiana for these kids?
Well, the next step is going to be, we got to provide more slots for early childhood education. I mean, we certainly do not have enough available slots for kids, particularly underprivileged kids, for early childhood pre-K slots. So next session, we're going to be working very zealously to open up more slots for those kids.
We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to Talk Louisiana. We are talking with Senator Cleo Fields from right here in Baton Rouge, District 14. We've talked about mandatory kindergarten, which is now the law in Louisiana after a bill that Senator Fields introduced this past session. And we want to talk a little bit about a session wrap and what you see as the highs and lows, Senator Fields, coming out of this session. This was a fiscal session, but it certainly went well beyond fiscal. What do you see as the accomplishment that you're most proud of from the legislature this session?
Well certainly
mandatory kindergarten.
Mandatory kindergarten, without a shadow of a doubt, is something that the legislature, prior to me getting there, has been working on for a long time. So that's accomplished. Teachers' pay. I mean, that was a big step in the right direction. Our teachers work so hard. I mean, and I was, very clear with this legislature. Our teachers, unlike teachers across the country, stayed in the classroom during the pandemic. They didn't leave the classroom. They taught our children, be it virtually or in person, and they deserve the pay raise. And it's unconscionable that our teachers are below the Southern regional average.
Do you think $800 a year went far enough?
I don't. I mean, and I've been very clear about that, and I make no apology about it. I mean, we had the resources. We could have done better. We should have done better. We didn't do better. And that's, but I'm not on any of the money committees. But I'm glad that we doubled what the governor recommended. The governor recommended $400, $200. We gave, $800, $400. So we took a big step. But did we take a big enough step? Probably not, but we did take a big step in the right direction. So I'm proud of the fact that we gave the teachers an $800, certified teachers $800 pay raise, and non-certified personnel $400. So that was a step in the right direction. So those are two big accomplishments from an educational perspective. Then we passed the Foster Promise program to give kids in community colleges an opportunity to take advantage of TOPS. We call it TOPS. So they got a chance they now have a chance to take advantage of a new TOPS program that we have created for them. And so those are some very, big changes in education, in my view.
1-877-217-5757 if you'd like to be part of the conversation this morning. 1-877-217-5757. There were some tense moments, Senator, in the legislature between various groups, and I know we like to say in Louisiana that we're not yet all the way down the partisan road of D.C., that we still talk together, but I'm thinking of the Legislative Black Caucus in the House and the Republicans in the House, and I know sometimes the Senate draws a distinction between its behavior and the House's behavior, but how did you find the atmosphere in the legislature this session?
The atmosphere in the let me not speak to the entire legislature, but in the Senate was okay. I mean, in the Senate, we tend to work with each other and talk to each other and work our differences out. Around the table, and we tried to present to the extent that we can a united front when we go into public. So I have not seen such a divisive body in the Senate. So from my perspective, I think the Senate has worked as a unified body.
Go ahead.
I can't speak that way for the House because I'm not a member of the House. But the legislation that I have pushed have, for the most part, gotten a bipartisan support.
So that sort of leads into my next question. The House is where a lot of the redistricting plan will start when that session happens. I saw one quote perhaps in early 2022, the redistricting session. But at whatever time it happens, what do you say to your constituents about, I've heard some reporters who cover this issue say, you know, this is not going to be something the general public is really going to, you know, either understand or pay attention to. What do you say to your constituents about what should they look for? What should they be on the alert for? What should they ask for in terms of redistricting when we have that session to draw maps for
districts? Well, I'm not on either of the committees. I'm not on Senate and Governmental Affairs, which is going to be the committee that's going to govern redistricting and House and Governmental Affairs on the House side. When I was chair of that committee several years ago, what we did, we actually went around the state and held hearings on the redistricting plans. Redistricting is something that you have to take to the people so that they can understand it, and you have to get them engaged. And I suspect that that's what we're going to do this year. I would certainly urge the committees to have joint hearings and move around the state and get the people engaged and let them see and make them a part of the decision-making process and plan development. And then, you know, once they get involved, then they see and know what's taking place, then they are more likely to support or not support a particular plan. And I suspect that's what they're going to do this session, or the next session, rather. And
what should people, as voters, what do you recommend people should want? Should we try to hang on to our current map as far as our districts? Are we looking to change?
Yeah, not at all. I think people should look for, you know, plans. They should look for plans that are first of all diverse. You know, I think diversity is a good thing, and I think that they should look for plans that are inclusive, and I think that you know, from all segments. I mean, I think they should. You know, when the redistricting committees or the Senate and Governmental, House and Governmental committees come to their districts, they have to hold them accountable. They have to say, well, why isn't this area, you know, with that area of the state, from congressional to legislative to BSEE? I mean, people have to play a role in those districts. They have to, you know, hold their legislators accountable. We had Supreme Court districts that failed in the House this session. I mean, we were moving from 7 to 9 Supreme Court districts that failed in the House. I mean, people have to pay attention to what the legislature is attempting to do from all levels of government so that they can play a role in it. I mean, that's going to be very important. I mean, I just think people need to pay attention to what we're doing in it. In the legislature.
You were first elected to the state Senate, I believe, at age 24 in 1987. Yep. Is there something that you would tell that younger Cleo all these years later in politics that you've learned that maybe you would approach things differently after your decades in politics?
Well, after serving in Congress and in the legislature, I would approach it a little slower. I have much more experience than I had then, but the same philosophy, the same, you know, I would approach it with the same, you know, philosophy, but much more, you know, but with much more experience.
And what is that philosophy?
You know, you have to, I mean, that was the time that I would approach it. Like, if I wanted it done, I would say, I'm going to get it done, and I get it done alone. I try to get it done alone. I try to approach things now with, I can't get it done alone. I need 19 other people, and so I try to build a coalition. So I try to be a coalition builder, and try to see other people's point of view.
And really, in the Senate, the 20 or so new senators this term, about half of those have experience from the House, right? Or they've served in politics before. So does that help in making compromises?
Yeah, most of them. I mean, most of them do. And the Senate is a great body. I mean, I don't know much about the House because I don't know much about the members who serve in the House and their backgrounds. But I do know all of the members of the Senate, and I've studied their backgrounds. They have, you know, and what I do when I approach members of the Senate, I know their backgrounds, so I try to approach them from where they live, where they come from, their backgrounds, and I try to see their points of view. So
it's been a pleasure having you on, Senator Fields. Thank you for your service in the State Senate and all these years. Thank you for discussing with us mandatory kindergarten, the new law in Louisiana. We'll be right back here on Talk Louisiana with Barry Irwin. All right. Good morning and welcome back to Talk Louisiana. We had a lively discussion with Senator Cleo Fields on the matter of education and what came out of the legislative session. We turn now to an expert, Barry Irwin, the president of Council for a Better Louisiana, who knows the Capitol better than most after many, many years in his young life covering the Capitol and leading cable. Good morning, Barry. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Julie. Thanks for having me.
When you gave your after-action review from cable at the very end of the session last week, one of the top lines in that review said, by almost any measure, Louisiana lawmakers took up some weighty issues during the session. The fact that they weren't able to accomplish everything to the degree that some had hoped doesn't diminish the fact that there were some major accomplishments this year. That's a pretty positive polish to the end of the session. Other reporters I've read have said the reason for any success at all in this session was literally billions of federal dollars in pandemic relief that the state received, kind of taking the pressure off funding-wise. Why do you give them sort of a positive review in the use of the phrase major accomplishments this year?
Well, you know, I think it's a combination of things. I mean, I will say having the money certainly helped in some areas. I mean, it helped with a huge investment in higher education, which we hadn't seen in a number of years. It helped get a little bit more of a teacher pay raise. It certainly helped put some money into some areas where we had federal dollars that were available, you know, to do some things like broadband, water systems, even some infrastructure. So that was one piece of it. Excuse me. But the other piece of it was they passed legislation that had really nothing to do with money. And I'm talking about areas like the tax reform. That was a restructuring of our corporate and individual income taxes that we've been talking about for years, and we could never move anywhere close to the finish line. They were able to do that. They passed some legislation dealing with centralized sales tax collection, which seems boring, but really for our businesses in the state, makes a huge difference in how they have to deal with the red tape and collecting and remitting sales taxes to the state. You know, marijuana decriminalization, that wasn't a money issue, but one can't argue or has to say that was a pretty significant change. So when you look at things in balance, I mean, there were things where I think money made a difference, but there were other policy changes that we have not been able to deal with until really this year.
If you'd like to talk with Barry Irwin or you have a question for him, you want to be part of the conversation this morning, the number is 1-877-217-5757. And I hesitate to wade into taxes on the radio, Barry, but you're one of the best communicators I know. So talk to us a little bit about what should people see as the impact to the taxes that they pay on their income as a result of what passed in this session.
You know, for individuals, it's really not going to be that much, and that was by design. The issue is that we have a tax structure that's more complicated than it is in other states, and the byproducts of that is that we have high tax rates but a low tax burden. We have a low tax burden because we have deductions and exemptions that other states don't have. So the picture we send to the rest of the country, to people who are looking to come here, whether it's businesses or individuals, is that we have high tax rates. They don't see, because it's kind of hidden, that we have low tax burden. So what this actually does is it gets rid of It's one of the big deductions that we have that virtually no other state has, but it allows us to lower our rates, so it looks much better. But for the individual, you don't feel much impact because the idea was to make it revenue neutral, both for the state and for individuals. So for most people, it's not going to be a difference. But really, for the message we send to the rest of the country and those who are looking outside into us, it looks like it will give the impression, which is true, that we'll have lower tax rates for than really any state in our region that does have income taxes. And that's positive for jobs and economic development.
Very interesting. Interesting. I want to turn to transportation. We all talk about in Louisiana our crumbling roads, our crumbling bridges. A lot of times when polls are run, people would be supportive of a gas tax, or the majority may be. But again, this session, the talk of gas tax kind of went away real early in the session. What is being done about infrastructure and transportation on the state level?
Well, you're right. There was a big talk right before the session and even at the beginning about, you know, an increase in the gasoline tax over a period of 10 years or so that would really ratchet things up to allow us to make some major investments that we haven't been able to make. That died pretty quickly. It didn't even really get out the door. So what legislators did during the entire session really was look for ways to find existing dollars that we have and somehow target those into infrastructure. They looked at various scenarios, but the one they came up with and the one that they ended up with was to take the vehicle sales tax that we're already paying that goes into the state general fund, but to phase that in over a couple of years or 2 or 3 years into dedicating that into transportation infrastructure. So what that would have done is basically put $300 million or more into transportation infrastructure that we're not doing right now. But it comes at a cost because it would have come out of the state general fund, which, you know, deals with higher education, healthcare, supports a variety of state services. But that was the deal that was sort of struck between the House and the Senate. I think the big question is whether the governor will veto that, and it seems very likely that he will veto it. So while at the end of the day the legislators passed some investment in infrastructure, it's unclear and maybe unlikely that we'll actually see that happen because of the governor's veto pen.
So then what do you think the governor's or others' plans are to fix roads and bridges in Louisiana?
You know, I think that's the big question. I mean, right now the issue that's kind of floating out there is that we think that there's probably going to be something done at the federal level that will enhance, you know, infrastructure investment, but states will have to participate by putting up money of their own to match those dollars and actually be able to draw them down. We don't know what that's going to look like because obviously no transportation bill is passed. But I think the challenge facing the state is that we are really at the end of the revenue sources that we have for making the match that really that we're already making for the existing dollars. So if there's another plan out there, we're going to have to step up with some more money. And I think that's the big question. Where is it going to come from? I think that's going to be driven a lot by what happens at the federal level. And I guess we'll see. We've seen other states do this in the past where they've come into special sessions, done whatever to increase gasoline taxes just to make sure that they could get the federal dollars that they were looking for. But I don't know if we know what plan B is at this point.
Well, we received somewhere along the order, and correct me if I'm wrong, of $3 billion from the federal government in pandemic relief. What happened to that money? What do you see? I know there's always a debate about one-time money, and sometimes it's put towards recurring expenses over the years. Sometimes that's a plan to try to get the legislature to try to fund these things in the future. But what happened with our pandemic relief money?
Well, I think a lot of it did go to some one-time things that will be very useful. I mean, kind of lost in the shuffle was that the legislature did dedicate, may not be the right word, but target about $500 million to infrastructure. Those are one-time dollars. They're not recurring, but because infrastructure is kind of a one-time expense, they will allow us to make a pretty significant investment in, you know, roads and bridges and that type of thing. They also put a lot of money into water systems around the state, and if anybody keeps up with that at all, it's not so much an issue here in Baton Rouge, but in a lot of rural areas, and I'm talking about a lot around our state, we have crumbling water systems that really have safety issues and public safety health concerns, that a lot of that's going to be able to go towards fixing some of those things. Smaller amounts went to things like expanding broadband and trying to help other groups, particularly industry groups that were hard hit by the pandemic. But I will say this, we didn't spend all the money that's available to us. We put a bunch of that in reserve. So this was only sort of like the first installment of the dollars that are available. And we'll see later on what the legislature chooses to do with those other dollars that are either still on the table or will be coming to the state over the next year or so.
Let's talk a little bit about personalities in the legislature, and we're never short on those. You just read the newspaper today and this weekend, and we've got a lot of back and forth with different personalities in the legislature. What stood out to you as far as the interpersonal relations at the legislature this year?
Well, you know, the one that really caught the headlines just in the last few days was the altercation of whatever variety it was between Representative Alan Seabaugh from Shreveport and Melinda White from the Bogalusa area. I mean, one of the things that happens, and you've been down there and others have too, is especially at the end of the session, tempers get frayed, people are tired, there's a lot of fatigue and frustration going on, and people say and do things that perhaps they would regret. Obviously, there was a something there, an altercation that somehow dealt with maybe getting a gun, and that was certainly one that's regrettable and one that, you know, we'll see what happens there. But there was also kind of an undertone, undercurrent, you know, on some racial issues, which I think was very unfortunate. I think there was some sense from the Legislative Black Caucus that while we were doing some things that benefited, you know, people at one income level or in businesses or corporate groups, we weren't doing things at the other end of the spectrum. And I think you saw some of that play out. There was.
Do you think that that was able to be healed before the end of the session, or is that going to take a lot longer?
You know, I think these things tend to work themselves out. I'll give credit to our legislators. They get into really difficult battles over policy, and, you know, sometimes it gets personal. But, you know, to a large degree, I find that those things get worked out, and I'm certainly hopeful that will happen again this time, but we'll see.
What about constitutional amendments in the 30 seconds or so we have left? We've got some coming up for the voters to decide on October 9th, right?
Yeah, there's, I think, going to be four. I think two of them are not huge, but I think that the ones that are of interest to a lot of us deal with the tax reform issues that we talked about. There's two of them. One deals with the individual income tax and the corporate income, and they're tied together. And the other deals with making it, you know, easier for businesses to collect and remit sales taxes. They're not sexy in a lot of ways, but they really are substantive, and hopefully voters will take a real close look at those, and hopefully we'll see some progress there.
Barry Irwin, president for Council for a Better Louisiana, we can't thank you enough for sharing your expertise, your wisdom with us. Continue to keep our Louisiana voters and citizens updated, as cable always does. Thank you again for your work, and we'll be back with Randy Gurry and the Old War Cadets. And welcome back to Talk Louisiana. We are pleased to be finishing up this show today on Flag Day. It's not only Flag Day, it's the U.S. Army's birthday, with a conversation with Randy Gurry. And Randy is the executive director of the Old War School Cadets. I think I call them the Old War Cadets. Actually, the school's old, the cadets might not be. So, Randy, welcome to live in studio here at Louisiana Radio Network. We are really thrilled to have you here, and thank you for coming to talk to us about the new LSU Military Museum. And I know it's in the Memorial Tower, and there was some private money that was raised to do this refurbishment, but you've mentioned before in other interviews you've done about this opening that really the Old War School, the cadets of the Old War School, are the occupants of the Memorial Tower. So welcome to Talk Louisiana, and tell us about this project.
Good morning, Julie.
Thank you
for having me. Yes, we were fortunate in the early 90s, late 90s, the LSU Board of Supervisors established us as the primary occupant for Memorial Tower with the understanding that it would become the LSU Military Museum. Because Dr. William Brookshire has made the major donation for the museum. We reference it first as the William A. Brookshire LSU Military Museum, and then generally we'll refer to it as LSU Military Museum, but we're grateful for his initial contribution.
Well, and he is also the person who contributed, I believe it was around $1 million for the Veterans Center,
the Student
right?
Veterans Center, yes.
Right, which the Louisiana Department of Veterans Affairs Very. Works to help staff that.
Yep.
And so
Very generous.
Yeah.
Very generous.
Yeah. Oops, we've got... There we go. But so tell us a little bit about the LSU Military Museum. I know that there's been a soft opening. I guess the grand opening of sorts will be around
November.
Veterans Day.
It'll be Veterans Day night.
Okay.
Yeah. There's some ongoing conversation that we might open between now and November on a limited basis because there are a lot of people who do want to see it. So we're trying to figure out how we can do that. We need to tweak some exhibits. We have some logistical things that we discovered during the soft opening.
Which was about a week, right?
It was about a week, 6 days, yeah.
And what kind of exhibits are we talking about? The Memorial Tower doesn't seem like a huge building to me.
It's not large.
So.
It's not nearly large enough.
So what do people see?
What they will see when they enter the rotunda initially will be a grouping of items, artifacts, memorabilia that sort of track the 160-year time of LSU's military. The North Gallery, which will be on the right as they walk in, we refer to as the early years. Starts 1860 up till and through World War II. The South Gallery is what we call the new era, the modern era, and it will carry from Korea to the present. Through the Afghan Wars, Desert Storm, et cetera.
If you'd like to talk to Randy Gurry or you have a question about the new military museum at LSU, it's 1-877-217-5757. And Randy, tell us a little bit, for the folks who don't know what the cadets of the old war school, what is that and what do they do?
When General Middleton was first at LSU as president, he, like most generals, was accustomed to having a group of, let's say, advisors around him. So he formed Cadets of the Old War School as a support group, advisor group for himself, because he was new in that position, obviously, academically. He had been Commandant of Cadets. He had been a number of things, but that was new to him. So it started as a group of people who had been on the old campus downtown, where the state capitol is now, which was our campus, which most people don't realize. But they then came, of course, those people came to the current campus. And through the years, those people would meet. They met annually as a group, but they also supported him in his work. I would see them. I was president of student body my senior year, and we had an annual meeting. They had an annual meeting, so our paths would cross at least once a year. But I noticed that their membership began to decline, and I couldn't figure out what was going on. Obviously, they were dying off, and so when Bud Davis was our chancellor, I'm sure you remember Bud.
Yes.
He told us, he said, well, why not just re-engineer the organization, which we did, and it's brought us to where we are today.
So what is it made up of today?
Cadets of the Old War School is comprised of basically anyone. I mean, I could just say it that way, but initially it was people who had attended LSU, even for a semester, if they graduated, if they were commissioned, if they weren't, if they were there 2 years, they were there 4 years, if they, you know, whatever. We now have corporate folks. We now have what's called affiliates.
Do they have to have served in the military?
No, they do not have to. It's a lot like alumni by choice, but we refer to ABC. So really anyone who would like, if they have an affinity for the military and would like to be involved, we certainly would welcome them.
And so you were involved, along with many other people, I guess, in trying to refurbish the Memorial Tower itself. This is something that I was interested to read. Actually, had its beginnings with the American Legion?
Yes. American Legion, and in 1919, when American Legion was in existence, and it was sort of, I'm part of the Boyd Ewing Post here, but we just celebrated our 100th anniversary. In 1919, the American Legion nationally encouraged, if not challenged, all of the states, all the existing states, to honor their state war dead in some way by a building, fountain, an obelisk, whatever. So the American Legion Post of Louisiana raised the money. It was a little less than $300,000. that they raised, and they got a few thousand from the state. It was about a $300,000 project. But they were the prime movers, motivators. They got it designed and paid for it. And then when we dedicated our new campus, April 30th, 1926, they then deeded it to LSU.
And it's such an iconic LSU building. And I don't know if many people think about that it's actually to honor our servicemen and women.
For Louisiana, which is it's different. Like the LSU War Memorial on the parade ground honors those war dead from World War II forward.
Okay.
And so it's two different things, but it's very significant. It truly is the university's icon. I mean,
you talk about $300,000 to start it out, and now I think this project I read somewhere it's more than $14 million.
Yes, it was. I told someone the other day, I said what started out as a $6 million project overnight morphed into about a $14.5 million project. And when I tell you that it looks every cent, every penny of that $14.5 million, it is absolutely gorgeous. It's truly a building that is appropriately fitting to honor those who have served, even those who have died from LSU. And we're so very proud to be there and to have the opportunity to show off.
So is it something that you would say families and parents and children should plan to visit?
Absolutely. We've done a thing educationally. We talked about it for months before we did it, but QR codes on the exhibits so that the children can use their phone. They love their toys.
Yes.
So if they can use their toy. And
I know a lot of parents who like their toys.
Oh, yes, a lot. Many. I was going to say younger and older children. But if they use their toy, it will bring up additional narrative for that, which it will also allow us in the future to program into those exhibits some video that we don't have in there presently.
Do you have staff there at the museum?
We have some, not as many this summer. We have some student assistants at work. Ellen Brown, who was at the State Archives, is our curator.
Yeah.
Cliff Deal was our consultant from X Plus in Virginia. He actually is from Lafayette, but he was working with them. We will eventually be hiring a director of the museum. So,
will it be open at all this summer?
That's what we're talking about, is trying to find a way to at least maybe a couple of days a week, perhaps, to have it open. One during the week, like on a Wednesday, and perhaps one on a Saturday weekend, so that you can catch people both ways. And if people wanted to bring a group, we certainly could open it for the group. We will have tours. We've already booked our first tour for next February, so it's.
Did you serve in the military yourself?
I was in the Army. Got my commission.
And happy birthday to the Army today.
Yes. And Flag Day, I think, and all that other. All the other good days.
So many of our parents and previous generations were involved when there was a draft, and now we know that less than 1%, volunteered to serve in our American military. Do you see a difference from the time when you, I don't know if you were drafted or not, but when you signed up to serve?
I was commissioned through ROTC.
Okay.
I went 4 years in ROTC.
Okay.
And then went on active duty.
In the way people think about military service, and
I think part of it is yes, there's a difference, but I think part of that is because we, as military alumni at LSU particularly, have done not as good a job as we could have and should have done to help educate the incoming freshmen. Let's say our faculty, our staff. Very few people know about the military history of LSU. We're fortunate. We have an author that's writing presently, is writing a new book for us. It's The Military History of LSU.
Randy Gurry, I want to thank you so much for joining us and for reminding us to be thankful for the military service of the men and women who gave all and went and served for us. Thank you for your service. And we want to encourage people to visit the LSU Military Museum and the Memorial Tower when it opens up. Thank you for being here. And it's been a pleasure hosting here on Talk Louisiana. Jim will be back later this week.
We remember.